Michigan HockeyCast 4.14, where hopefully neither of us will receive a 5-minute podcast misconduct. Alex, we got several comments about a tennis podcast and a half that we did, and you sort of teased this a couple weeks ago. But we never really got to it, and fair, because there's a lot of hockey to deal with and other things, but do you have any opinions on what has happened in the Aussie Open so far? I know there's been some other storylines, but it seems like there are some usual characters still around, but also a couple of people making runs.
I think tonight I'm very fascinated in the...
Tonight being Monday night.
Monday night, so it will already have happened.
Yes.
But Shapovalov was playing Nadal tonight, which is a really... Which, by the way, very weird that they got scheduled for the 10 p.m. match and not the 4 a.m. match.
Because it would be prime time in...
4 a.m. is the prime time match in Australia, and they put Monfils Berrettini is the 4 a.m. match, which I don't really get at all. I mean, Monfils has always been a fan favorite, but he's not going to draw a bigger crowd than Nadal. So I don't know what the story is with that, but...
Do you think that the Shapovalov is better for Canadians and Nadal is just a bigger name worldwide, so they're all going to be able... You'll be able to watch it, at least part of it in the U.S. if you're willing to stay up to midnight.
Yeah, I mean, I get that argument, but I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, Shapovalov's a guy who's always all over the place. Sometimes he's on, sometimes he's not. I mean, he made the semis at Wimbledon, and I believe he took a set off Djokovic, or at least he was close. So if he's on, he can absolutely beat Nadal. He had match points against Nadal on clay in a smaller tournament. I think it was Barcelona back in May. You know, it's a chance for him to get a career-defining victory. It was last year that Tsitsipas beat Nadal in the quarters in Australia, and that kind of announced him as a real contender, and then he went to the finals of the French Open, the next slam after that. So it's a big moment for Dennis. I'm interested in that one. You know, there's a lot of people in this tournament that I liked who just showed up terrible. You know, Sabalenka was my pick for the tournament. She got beat this morning.
Right.
But you could tell after the first match when she showed up in Australia, she had no shot to win it because she was double faulting like 15 times per set. So
that's a lot.
The fact she got that far playing like that was kind of a dead giveaway.
Well, in some college hockey ties, Pegula is still around, right?
Yeah, poor Pegula.
Because...
Her Bills got beat yesterday.
Yeah,
but
I don't have the energy to talk about that right now.
But
she's in the quarters. That's good.
Her Collins and Madison Keys, three Americans on that side.
Yeah.
So
do you think she has a shot of beating Barty?
No, not really. I mean, you know, it's women's tennis. It's a three-set match. Anything can happen. But
do you take her or Shapovalova?
I like Dennis's chance more than... Okay. I mean, Barty's playing really, really well, and she seems like she's on a mission to finally do it in front of the home crowd.
Right.
I like Madison Keys, though she's playing just tremendously after the worst year of her career last year, and she's playing Krejcikova tonight, and I think that whoever wins that match is the only person who can stop Barty in the field. Now that Sakkari's gone, now that Sabalenka's gone, now that Halep is gone, which, by the way, I don't think you watched any of that, but... Halep just got crushed by the Australian heat last night. I mean, she could not. She was throwing out or was close to throwing up.
Yeah, there's some... I can't remember her name, but there. Yeah, dude, I was talking to somebody about it, and they were like, you know, she was just bent over for, like, once you got in the second set.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fun quirk that I always think is great about the Australian Open. And it goes away by the end of the tournament because then they do all the night matches, but... It is the only Grand Slam where heat is like a massive factor. The French Open and Wimbledon are always very mild. The U.S. Open can have some hot days, but nothing like that.
But they play a lot of the U.S. Open at night, too.
Yes. So the Australian Open, there's always 2 to 3 days each year where the heat is just smothering, and it always makes somebody crumble. So that was kind of fun to watch. And then to finish the thought on the men's side, I mean, it's Medvedev's to lose at this point to me. I mean, obviously, you don't want to count out Rafa, but Medvedev's the better hardcore player at this point in their career, respective careers. He's dropped a couple sets, and he was kind of rattled last night against Maxime Cressy, but I mean, he's still the guy.
What would have to happen in your personal career for you to do his FIFA celebration?
I have no idea.
What if you sold a book? Would you do it at a bookstore?
No.
If you were doing a signing and people start lining up before you sign your first book, would you do it?
No.
I think you should.
What
if one of your posts got more hits than one of Brian's game columns? Would you do it then?
I think that's already happened because of the recaps.
Ooh.
But that's not really an achievement. It's just when it was posted and what is the subject matter. But anyway, I'm excited to see if Tsitsipas plays Medvedev in the semis because they have a great rivalry. Childhood friends, all-time hitting partners, their parents are friends, and now they hate each other. So that's a great storyline. But Tsitsipas isn't playing that great, and he barely got past Taylor Fritz.
Yeah, that was
morning.
A great match, wasn't it?
Yeah, five sets. So we'll see. But it's been pretty fun so far, so we'll see how it finishes up. Two Canadians in the quarters in the men's side and three American women in the quarters on the women's side. So nice day for the North American countries. And also two Italians on the men's side in the quarters. Hmm. So that's the
rundown?
That's the rundown.
All right. Well, we'll move right along into hockey, where Michigan went to Minneapolis and played two games against the Gophers, and they played really well, I think, in one game, and well enough in certain ways to win in another game, but it's weird because they get 1 point of the three in the first game in a game that, in some ways, you'd argue they probably could have or should have won, and the second game they probably did not play as well, but finished their chances and ended up on the scoreboard smoking Minnesota and getting 3 points. And so that's a little bit of a summation of what hockey is sometimes, where you can play really well and not get the breaks and then play super well or play not so well and then not get them and end up with what you should have had the first time. So in some ways that's what happened in the series.
Yeah, I mean, it was the encapsulation of hockey. I'm probably going to do a post on my Substack revisiting my NHL predictions and from October at the halfway point of the season. And the biggest takeaway will be that just goaltending is the ultimate wild card in the NHL about which teams are deviating, and that was this weekend, right?
Yeah.
Goaltending is the wild card. You can have a really great team, but if you think your goalie is going to be great and then he's terrible or vice versa, that totally changes the picture. And certainly the Saturday game, goaltending was the big story.
Quick, more random, hockey or baseball?
Or
too close to call?
I would say hockey probably, but it's close.
Okay. Because I kind of start thinking that too. And those are the two sports, right, where you get the one position like you were saying.
Goaltending is random in the sense that goalies over time empirically are very unpredictable. They have really great seasons and the same guy will be terrible the next year. But
pitching can be like that though.
Pitching can be like that too. But this weekend goaltending was not random. One team had a very good goalie and one team had a bad goalie. And that's like just very clear from watching the tape.
Yeah.
So this wasn't, you know, oh, the bounces went our way or whatever, which is what people often say about randomness in hockey. This was not that.
Yeah, it wasn't bounces. It was more, well, we'll get that in. That was more, I would say, the second game than the first game. So we'll get into that in the second segment. We won't give away all of the secrets early. So Michigan starts the first game, and, like, they didn't get a shot for, like, the first, like, 10 or 12 minutes. And now part of that is what we're going to talk about, all of the power plays to Minnesota. But it just starts kind of poor. Beniers tackles a player from Minnesota, and all of a sudden you get a power play and for the Gophers, and it's not a great power play. They get a couple chances. Portillo makes couple saves, including a nice one towards the end of it. McLaughlin had a chance, I think, near the post, and he kind of waited a little bit too far and moved away from the opening as Portillo didn't quite get to the post and ended up being a save. But and Michigan escapes that one. So Minnesota gets a couple of breaks, but don't really take advantage.
Yeah. I didn't think they were A-plus chances necessarily, but Michigan was a little slow out of the gate.
Yeah. And they did get a couple looks after that, Michigan, but nothing on net. As Lambert had a really good look along the goal line, and by really good look, I don't mean look at the net, but he had probably Michigan's best chance at that time. But he didn't really have an angle, and he shot it, and it basically went parallel to the goal line. And if he scores, it's a really, really nice goal. That's maybe not Lambert's forte, but he does have a look. And then Samo gets into the slot, and he had a decent look, but he skied his into the mesh. And right after that, Van Wyk trips a guy, or kind of trips a guy. I think that was the one we were like, well, I'm not really sure on relook, but maybe he got him. And Minnesota gets the second power play. This one is, I thought, a pretty good kill from Michigan. They have really nice clear from Person Edwards and Blankenberg, where it's guys know what they're doing. You get a guy that seals off the puck and takes his guy out. The next guy reads the play, passes to the spot where he knows his teammate is going to be, who takes the puck and clears it. And those are the types of things that you're starting to see more from Michigan's penalty kill, instead of just the panic button, freak out, throw it along the boards or throw it wherever. But it's like sometimes making a quick pass to a certain spot and another pass, and then you get an easy clear.
Yeah, they did their job in that first period on the penalty kill. I want to point out one thing about the first period.
Okay.
There people associated with the program that are on Twitter sort of were tweeting about, I guess, belief in the locker room among the coaches that the first period that you play on the road in Minnesota every year is going to be a rough period, because they have the advantage of being familiar on the Olympic ice sheet and you don't, and teams often just take a little bit of time to get a feel for that, at least visiting teams do.
So I've heard that before Michigan goes to Northern, or when they used to go to Northern more, or now Minnesota, or places like that, they'll practice at the Cube, because the Cube has an Olympic ice sheet.
It's
like
possible.
The week before.
It's possible,
so
yeah.
You're not just going in.
But there's a difference between practicing on,
sure,
an Olympic ice sheet and,
sure,
actually playing on an Olympic ice sheet.
But they should. I mean, in theory, you would think you should try to do that, right? Like, why?
Well, yeah, I mean, you want to, but there's a real adjustment when it comes to the game action.
Right, and you could see that with Michigan, as they did struggle. And they took their third penalty. Nolan Moyle got called for this one. And that was, I don't have as many notes on that. I had Portillo did give up a rebound, and it looked almost like Power was going to cover a puck, but didn't. And Portillo got ran into a little bit by Hughlin. And so Michigan kind of gives up three power plays. And you're just like, okay, you can't continue to do this. I know that Minnesota's power play coming into the weekend was only at, like, I think 17%, and Michigan had killed their previous, what was it, 23, I think. They were that, which is, you know, becoming one of the strengths of their team now. And it kind of goes back to the thing that we talked about earlier, where they're not making as many panic plays, but becoming comfortable and making the smart plays to get clears and such. And Michigan does get a couple power plays in the first period. So basically the first period is just special teams. I mean, you have at least half of the minutes, right? Because you have five power plays, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And they didn't do a ton on either of theirs. They get one late at the end of the first period. They get almost a rush and then almost turn it over. And Minnesota almost goes the other way. And then you get kind of the bottom end of Michigan's power play, where they can't really get it in the zone. And so it was like a very weird first period, where I think they started like 8 or 9-0 in shots in favor of Minnesota, and they get a few at the end because of the power play. And then finally they get their feet under them after their first period on Olympic ice, I guess, this year.
Say that again?
This would have been their first period on Olympic ice.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
After that...
Yeah, there wasn't any other one.
After that, it seemed like they looked better, because the second period was much better.
Yeah.
And in that one, they get a power play earlier to start. Brinkman took out Beecher. I think it was a cross check in front of the net. And that is where Michigan sort of starts their puck dominance, I think, because Close makes a save on power, and Minnesota at that point then is just packing the house, right? Like, they do this throughout the game, but specifically on this power play, they were playing with five goalies because it looked like guys were all jammed in. Michigan has control of the puck for pretty much most of the power play and in the zone, but they can't really get a good look. And they get a couple shots from distance, but that sort of sets the tone for the rest of the period, as Michigan is mostly going to have control of the puck and be making plays.
Yeah, the thing about collapsing into the slot is that sometimes it screens your goalie from far out.
Yeah.
If the shot's coming in from the point, and you do have that where sometimes the seeing eye shot comes through all the bodies, but in this situation, they were pretty content to block a lot of shots. And I mean, the other thing is that when you do collapse into the slot like that, it makes it a lot easier to take away the cross seam pass. So you give up a lot of spaces on the perimeter, but you do take away the ability to change sides for the most part, and then obviously sort of protect the area right around the crease. So
you also tend to clear rebounds because everyone is there and their sticks are around, and so if there's a rebound, you have chances because you're not spread out and have one guy maybe that has a chance.
Yeah, but if they take a shot and it just bounces off of them right back to the guys on the perimeter, that can happen. You can get trapped for a while.
Sure, I just meant more rebounds off the goalie.
Yes.
Where, like, dead yeah. pucks and all
yeah.
that. You don't have open guys quite as often. So after that, Beecher had a really open look, and surprise, he shot it too high. But this was also a theory, too, that, like, we addressed last week that Jack LaFontaine had left Minnesota, so they're playing Justin Close. He's a smaller guy, I think under 6 feet, so, like, okay, 20 years ago he's probably average size, but now, he, in terms of goalies, especially when you stand next to Mount Portillo, he's pretty small. So Michigan, I think, was shooting high a lot. And Minnesota's reaction to having Close in net was to sort of do what Michigan did when they had Hunwick, which was, hey, this guy's going to have to come out to challenge shots, so there's going to be rebounds and he's going to be out of the net. You better be back blocking shots and getting into position and not allowing those tapping rebounds.
Yep. I will say that what's interesting about what we see in the second period developing is this game turns really more into a kind of, a grinded out game, playing particularly off puck retrievals and on the cycle, which in theory isn't supposed to happen on an Olympic ice shoot, right? The idea is that
Minnesota and Michigan.
Yeah, you're supposed to have more space, all that kind of stuff. But Michigan in the second period really starts ramping up their forecheck, and they're playing really well on the boards, winning a lot of puck battles and that sort of thing that we haven't seen a whole lot from this group. So I was pretty impressed by that.
Yeah, and it ends up paying off as they get a cycle play that gets the puck to the point and Pearson. I struggle so hard with calling him Pearson. It just, like, every time, we'll like, you and I watch this game together, and I probably said his name however many times and always call him Pearson, but it's Pearson. That spelling just, I don't know, it always gets me. Anyway. He gets the puck at the point, throws a shot that we think is his sort of assist, but Beecher, I guess, like, almost shot blocks it and tips it from range, and it then hits Samoskevich, like, in the chest. And you can see Sam was not expecting that, because I think the original shot from Pearson was supposed to be on net, and it's way off. It's several feet off because of the Beecher deflection. Hits Samo in the chest, drops down in the slot. Duke has the rebound and just dunks it home for a Michigan 1-0 lead. You noticed something interesting, because we went back at the end of the period to look at this and rewound it four or five times, that number six for Minnesota, I think Koster, had some issues locating people on this shift.
He's really just kind of standing around, and the way that the defense sort of breaks down, he's kind of left in a position where he's not picking anybody up, and in theory could have helped out on Duke, but he's kind of got his back to the play, and
yeah,
he's just kind of standing there.
I mean, in theory, if he's doing what he should be doing on and in the spot that he should be, Duke probably has a much more difficult attempt on that.
Yep.
But in this situation, kind of lost his space for a little bit of time, and Duke gets the lead. And at that point, you're feeling pretty good because you're like, you know, you survived the first period, you survived all those power plays and sort of the Minnesota onslaught, and then you get sort of a goal that is not been typical of Michigan as much this year, sort of a greasy rebound dunk because of a really nice play by, I mean, evidently Beecher, who tipped the puck too, but Duke, who's been, you know, doing this more and getting to the net and being able to finish some pucks. And you're thinking, okay, if we can get another one, we're looking pretty good. And they do get a couple other chances. Brisson had a blast from the slot after a really nice play from Estapa on the boards. And again, that's something that, you know, we're talking about is Michigan won some board battles. And do you think part of that has been moving Estapa up from line four, where they split up the top line, they play Bordolo with Brisson like they did for the first half of the year. Now they put Estapa on that line. They've tried different guys with them, but Estapa is an interesting guy because he's kind of the big piece that wins the board battles, that gets to the front of the net with a shooter like Brisson and a creator like Bordolo. I saw that and I kind of was intrigued.
Yeah, I like Estapa. I like his abilities as a puck retriever, and especially if you're going to play Bordolo and Brisson together, you don't really have someone who is a really good retriever. Bordolo can transport it the way Beniers can, but he's not physical enough and he's not big enough right now to really go into those corners and win a lot of battles. And so Brisson, I think, has gotten better at that, but that's not really what you want your shooter to be doing necessarily. And so Estapa fits there, and I think that he brings a physical presence to that line. And I've liked what I've seen. He has a touch of skill in this game too, and so I'm open to seeing where they take it.
Yeah, I agree. Later on, or just after that, Owen Power got a look down the wing. It was a pretty good chance, but a save from close. And that's, you know, Power's had some chances to score goals in the last few games, has just missed the net a couple times, hit the post once, and now has forced a save here. I think that it's a little bit like Edwards in some ways, where Edwards had started activating and creating good chances. I mean, I think it's a matter of time before Power starts getting another goal or two, because he's been in good he's been in good space, and he has scored goals in the past, so you know that there is a history of him being able to shoot, and it's just sort of a matter of time before he puts a couple in, I think. And then right at the end of the second period, Minnesota gets their fourth power play. Portillo makes a really nice save. Samuskevich trips a guy. They go to the penalty kill. Minnesota gets a 3-on-2 that they probably should have scored on, but the guy near the net misses his shot wide, thankfully for Michigan in that situation. And then this is where we looked at this whole penalty kill too, and Michigan kind of got trapped along the boards. Van Wy got caught between getting down in the corner and up by the point. It ended up leading to...
But he also wasn't doing anything.
Well, he did not get trapped. He got lost, I guess would be the right way to say it. And it ended up leading to a great chance from Ben Myers about 5 feet in front of Portillo. And I think Eric got a piece of it as he came out the challenge of it, just deflecting it high. Probably the best chance of the night for the Gophers.
Yeah, that was a situation where you had a guy just all alone in front, one behind the net, one in front of the net, and you know, Portillo came up big in that moment.
And he came up big pretty much all weekend, as we'll continue to get to. I have a couple notes we haven't touched on of a good Portillo save, a nice Portillo save. It hasn't always fit sort of the narrative of how we're talking about this, but pretty much the underlying theme throughout the weekend is he's made almost all the saves that you expect him to make, and a handful of them like this, where it's do or die, and are you going to maintain a lead or, you know, keep your team in the game, and he did. I ended the third period. What did you feel going in the third period? Were you confident that Michigan was going to be able to see the game out?
I mean, I thought they were in a good position, but you're only up one goal, and teams constantly get tight in those situations, and there's just so many things that can happen.
Edwards walked in off a nice play from Beniers to start the period. That doesn't go in. And then pretty soon after that, you get just a really nice play by... on a redraft, you would say this guy would have been a first rounder. He ended up being, what, a late second or third rounder?
Yeah,
Matthew Nyes.
52 or something like that.
Yeah, so he gets kind of a long... It was a really... It didn't seem like a dangerous situation. He had... The puck is sort of loose to the right of Portillo along the goal line. Edwards is there, technically, and it looks like he's trying to use his leg to move it because it's in too close to him, and Nye sort of reaches around him, bats the puck out of the air as it's bouncing, and shoots it from about, I would say, 6 inches to a foot off the ice. And Portillo's not completely expecting this as it kind of comes and hits him on the inside of his left pad and trickles then between his legs and into the net. And there's a little debate as to, like, should Portillo have been down and expecting that? And I'm not really sure because, this was just a really nice play from Matthew Nyes.
So I think the thing on this one is, and I'm not a goalie scout or really have ever played goalie, but when the goalie is in that situation, you make a decision how you're going to stand, basically. What position, what form you're going to be in when you stand. Obviously, depending on how you're standing, that's going to open up some degree of a lane for a puck to come through. And I think for me, I'm just going to more tip the cap tonight for finding that on an obscure play like that. I mean, when I was watching it live, I thought it went in off a shin or something. It looked like the puck had just been thrown forward and it just randomly bounced in. And instead, it was actually a very skilled play. And it's kind of the quintessential Matthew Nyes goal, right? He's a physical guy. He's very developed for his age physically. He likes to play around the net. But the quirk is he's got really, really good hands. And that's what you saw right there.
And so it's 1-1 in a game, like you said. You know, Michigan's playing pretty well. But one goal lead, anything can happen. And Minnesota then takes the lead 2-1 on basically their next rush with a goal.
Okay, okay. The way I watched that play, Portillo, I think, kind of stopped playing when he heard the whistle.
Okay. Well, I was bearing the lead there, but I was going to get to that. But yes.
I mean, that was a play that was obviously offsides at the line. And, I mean, wasn't there a big scrum right after the goal was scored?
Sure. I mean, there
was that. Because that normally happens when a play is obviously offsides and you shoot anyway.
But it wasn't clearly offsides to the point where everyone stops playing and one guy comes in and scores.
Like, that was a thing in some of the old NHL video games. I don't know if it's still in there, but if you entered offsides and then you still shot after the whistle, that instantly triggered a fight every time.
Well, it was called back for offsides, and you think that Portillo just kind of was like, hey,
that's what it looked like to me. Okay. But
I was trying to add suspense because it's radio. So, you know those old plays where you're like, you describe a diving catch, but in reality it's a pop-up?
Yeah, I mean,
that's what I was going for here.
That was Ronald Reagan's first job. Yeah. He would get the wires of the baseball games and he'd just make up
whatever happened.
Yeah.
Hey, maybe I'll be president.
You just get a printout of, like, fly out to center field, then you get to decide how that what that looked like.
Jim Edmonds layout over his shoulder. Yeah. So it's 1-1. That goal gets called back because it never really counted to begin with. And then we get sort of the inverse of the Nyes play as KJ has an open net and the puck just hops over his stick. Otherwise, it's 2-1 Michigan, and you're like, so then you look back at the Nyes play and like, is that a really high skilled play or is it a play where it also takes a semi-high degree of luck?
No, that was a skilled play. Puck's in the air, you bat it out of the air.
So then is KJ's an unskilled play where he misses?
No, because that one bounced pretty late.
Okay.
Right in front of his stick.
Either way, and then you get one of the biggest talking points that we can have, other than the obvious one that's going to come near the end of this game, where Duke, after his goal, then gets into the zone in the slot and makes a phenomenal pass to Beecher, who's just cutting down the left side, and Close is stranded on some sort of island on the opposite side of the net. Johnny Beecher has a soccer-sized goal to shoot at, and somehow shoots it back across the open net, not on the short side, but on, I guess, the long side, and wide of that net into Justin Close, who has barely gotten into his break to push off from his left skate to come to the Beecher side of the net to make the save, and still somehow is able to make the save. And they get a zoom in of Beecher's face as he kind of U-turns, skates back up the boards, like he must have, like, cut off a teenage witch in traffic or something and is now will never be allowed to score another goal.
I mean, I thought that was a really good pass, not just like the pass across, but actually in terms of putting it in his shooting pocket. It wasn't a tough pass to handle. He didn't have to readjust at all.
Right.
And, you know,
tape to tape, as they
just misses the target. And there's not really much else you can say about that.
So who has a better chance of scoring a goal, Johnny Beecher or Patrick Stefan?
We'll leave that one up to the listeners.
Sorry, did I blindside you with that? All right, so after we... I mean, you and I looked at each other after that one, and we're just sort of, like, screaming relative pronouns here, right? Like, how and what, how, what... It's just sort of become a thing now because he's had so many of these breakaways and golden chances, and then this is like, I mean, there's not even a goalie in the crease in this situation, and so you're thinking after that point, like, I don't know, then, like, the way that sports works sometimes in, like, the spiritual world almost is if you don't take your chances, someone else is going to take a chance on the other team, and they're going to finish theirs, and, you know, Beniers... So the other thing that we didn't really talk about yet in this game that did happen was Beniers gets beaten as he's playing defense, and Portillo, for about the second or third time, like, pushes off the post to come out to face the shooter and kicks the net off. And that was it. I mean, on replay, you can see that happen at least twice. There might be an argument that he did it three times just in this game. He definitely does it on Saturday again. Like, that's, you mentioned this is the old Chris Osgood trick, right? When you're in some trouble.
Well, his was, you would come, like, more, I guess, deep into the play.
Okay.
And with that, it was more just like, oh, the net just, like, barely came off. This was just like, boom, it's been blasted off again. Like,
so is that
true? And I've never seen it happen that many times like that. That was very strange.
So is this, like, magnetism has lost its strength in Minneapolis, or is this just a mountain of a man that is just
I have to chalk it up to the arena, because this hasn't happened in any other weekends.
You know, it's funny because Nate Wells on Twitter was talking about one day an opposing goalie will get a penalty for this, but then it makes you think, if opposing goalies keep doing this, A, why doesn't the Minnesota goalie ever do it, and B, why don't you use some sort of stickier substance other than scotch tape to, like, hold the
I don't know.
And then we kind of get to what we're going to talk about. But so with a couple minutes left, I think it was about 2:30, 2:40. It's 1-1. This game looks like it's trending towards overtime. And Truscott approaches a Minnesota player behind the net. The player has most, if not all, of his back to Truscott, facing the boards, several feet away, is in not a dangerous position whatsoever, and Truscott gives him the old cross check to the back. He loses his balance, goes flying face first, hits the boards, and Truscott gets called for 5 and a game. And it was, I think, a good call. I mean, you know, there is an argument that says, hey, you know, stay on your skates, and he, you know, he didn't hit him that hard, you know, that sort of thing. But to me, it's, if you're Jacob Truscott, why are you doing this other than panicking? Like, what is the reason for
this? So what's interesting about the play is the fact that the Minnesota guy isn't really moving at all. Yes. There's no real... Truscott was not in trouble at all. I mean, the guy is there, sure, but, like, the reason for me it was a clear-cut major in the way they've been policing it this year is the fact that the guy isn't moving. You can't really make the argument of, like, oh, I went to hit him, and then he moved, and then, you know, lowered his head, and then now all of a sudden the head was in my shoulder range or whatever it was, and we were both moving at high rates of speed, and there's a lot of, like, random... Like, this guy wasn't moving at all. He was barely moving on the boards. I mean, to me, it was as clear-cut as it gets in the way they've been policing it this year. And when you apply the contact to the numbers as it was, and the face goes first into the boards, and the guy isn't really moving, like, there's no argument in the way it's being called this year. Like, so there's none.
This is just a panic play.
I don't even know what you would describe it as.
I mean, you couldn't think, oh, you know what I need to do here is cross-check this guy in the back, and that will put me in a better position. Like, there's no positive thing. Like, if you get beat in front of you see people coming back when there's a breakaway and the defenseman hooks him on purpose because you're like, I'd rather try to kill a penalty than give this guy, you know, a shot on net or something. And a breakaway chance. So in those situations, you're like, okay. Or in football, you know, cornerback tackles a receiver and takes his penalty and doesn't give up a touchdown. Those are things that are like, all right, you don't want to give a penalty there, but I see that. In this situation, it's just, I don't see any upside at all.
It's a bad, bad thing to have done.
And the thing is like, you know, Michigan does this consistently. And, you know, we've talked about majors in the past, and some of it, yeah, there have been bad calls. But the ones recently, there's not as many arguments. The one that Pearson got in Happy Valley, you know, what, a few months ago when they were there, I think that was a little unlucky because the guy gets down, and you can see Pearson's reaction. He's like, look, I didn't mean to do that. You know, the guy came down, yeah. I hit him as I was trying to check him into the boards. That one is probably more of a, all right, that's BS. But a lot of the ones recently and the ones that come to mind, like even the Van Wyver against Notre Dame, like, there's not a lot of argument on these.
Not really.
And Michigan doesn't take a lot of penalties like minor penalties. They take some, but it's not like they're taking 5 and 7 a game. They're not a penalty-heavy team, but they're taking five-minute majors at a almost one per game clip.
Not that many, but yes.
Well, in the last, I would say...
Well, that was 3 games in a row after that, so...
And they did in the Ohio State series, which was the last series of the first half. I mean, it's just been too consistent.
Yeah.
So at what point do you just have to change your approach?
Should have been a while ago.
But, I mean, now you have to sit down, and this is
I mean, they left Moyle out of the lineup in the second game, and that's something I would have done a while ago, is, like, we can't trust you. You're not providing offense, and you're regularly doing this.
And don't you think that was the other thing about Truscott? Is, like, we'd never seen anything remotely close from him this year, and all of a sudden you just get this one from him, and you're just kind of like, that seemed completely out of character.
Yeah, it's just a penalty you cannot take, because, you know, it removes any chance of you winning a regulation, more or less.
Yeah.
And then it really puts you in a very difficult spot for overtime with 3 extra minutes of 4-on-3.
Yeah. As soon as that happened and it was confirmed, which we thought it would be, I mean, the game was over. It was just, can Michigan get it to overtime to get the point? Because with 2-plus minutes of 4-on-3, forget it. Like, the 4-on-3, unless Minnesota can't find the net or Portillo flails perfectly and makes all the saves. I mean, the way that 4-on-3 is structured is just, it's almost impossible to kill for any length of time if the power play team executes it reasonably well.
Yeah.
So Michigan does temporarily give up a goal at the end of the game with, like, I think 5 to 10 seconds left. Portillo does make a glove save, Power gets a huge clear, and then McLaughlin gets down in front and, like, punts a goal over him. Like, the puck comes in front, and, like, there's always the debate of, like, the guy stopping, is that a kicking motion, which it's not, even though it kind of looks like it. But this was, like, the puck is bouncing, and he kicks it, skying the puck up and over Portillo into the net. And, I mean, that's as clear a kicking motion as I've ever seen, right?
Yeah. And I think that various hockey leagues should redefine it and basically just make it a simple, like, did the skate blade leave the ice? Because I think there's too often this year we see, at least in the NHL, where goals get called back, where it's just the guy trying to stop or whatever.
Yeah,
I think you should be able to kick it as long as your skate blade doesn't leave the ice, right? Anything with the foot, so if you just go like this,
so
you,
like,
know,
skate forward?
Yeah, or whatever it may. Like, I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with it, unless you have, like, the reason the rule exists is the safety component. And the safety component gets eliminated if your skate doesn't leave the ice. So I think anything off the foot in any capacity, as long as your skate blade doesn't leave the ice, should stand. And anything where it does leave the ice should, you know, be called back. And in this one, the blade very clearly left the ice, so...
And that essentially gave Michigan the 1 point that they ended up getting, because as you get to overtime, I mean, it just it, like I went in overtime being like pretty much like, okay, I'm just I mean, it's done, like, you know, eventually. And Blankenberg actually saved a goal really early on, and then Beniers had a really great sequence where he skated around with the puck for about 15 or 20 seconds.
They filled out about over a minute of it,
which is probably more than you'd expect.
Yeah, I mean, you want, any time you give a team a 5-on-3 or 4-on-3 for more than a minute plus, you know, then it's just, there's not a lot.
And
you're
Minnesota,
lucky to make it out of it in that situation if you do. So
yeah, the Gophers executed it really well. The puck went from one dot to the center to the other one, and the guy in the center faked the shot, drawing everyone's attention. And because it's 4-on-3, everybody's so much closer, and the shot comes from the opposite dot, and Portillo had no chance. I mean, you mentioned, yeah, maybe Beecher couldn't
get
over.
Beecher is back to the play, which you never want.
No, but he was also checking the guy that's right in front of Portillo. I mean, at that point, you just don't want people on the ice, and someone's going to be open. And so I just, you know, it's like, I hope he misses the net, and he didn't, and it was 2-1, and so Michigan gets 1 point, which after you have a 1-0 lead in the third period, you're kind of disappointed with, but at the same time, you're thinking, okay, they played pretty well, they took a dumb penalty at the end, they missed an open net or two. If they can play a little better tomorrow, maybe get a bounce or two, then you get 4 points, and it's okay. So you get potentially a win plus, again, maybe you want six, or even, you know, to win in overtime and get the 2 points, but getting the 1 point there was not enjoyable because of the way the game unfolded, but it was acceptable, assuming you back it up the next night.
Yeah, pretty much.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458, or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland.
On the way is the bluebird,
if to stay is a new bird. He sings a love song as we go along, walking in a winter wonderland. In the meadow, we can build a snowman and pretend that he's a circus clown.
We'll have lots of fun with Mr. Snowman.
Yes, until the other kiddies knock him down. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by the fire to face unafraid the plans that we've made, walking in a winter wonderland. Walking in a winter wonderland.
So while the game didn't end the same, it also felt like the Saturday game started the way that the Friday game started, where Michigan didn't really look great to start. Portillo Power kind of dropped a puck, and all of a sudden, you know, you get a rush coming in, and Portillo makes a save. And then Power had another goof where he kind of dropped the puck, lost his guy, and Portillo made another save, and you're just like, okay, this is some, like, janky stuff to start here. We're really going to need this game. And then you and I just went back and looked at this. There was a comment in my breakdown about, I used probably some poor language of Johnny Beecher. While we went back and looked at it, it probably was his fault. I said he abandoned his man. He didn't. He actually did the right thing for probably 60 to 75% of this play, but he carries his man into the zone, Truscott goes deep with him, and then it's a kind of a 3-on-3, but the third guy in for Minnesota is late, so because it's during a change, and Beecher carries his man, Truscott then picks him up, and Beecher turns to find the third guy, but instead of sort of charging out at him, he kind of goes low to block the shot, potentially screening Portillo, and Brodzinski, the third guy in, shoots one and scores. It's tough to see if Portillo was screened. It's certainly possible with the size Beecher is, and Beecher could have, when we were looking at it, you were like, he could have come out another stride or two and maybe made the shot more difficult on Brodzinski.
Yeah, that's what I would say. I'd rather him just do come out a little bit farther to provide a little more resistance, but that's a tough situation.
Yeah, and that was just... Because it's tough to fault him because he's carrying the guy in the zone and picking up his man, which is what you want to teach a centerman to do.
Yeah.
So again, now Michigan is now, this time they're in a hole. They didn't start really well offensively. And this time they do give up a goal and it's 1-0. That's kind of frustrating because, like, you know, we talked about what happened in the first game and you kind of need this win. And then Edwards kind of fumbles a puck behind his net and takes a penalty. And it's now you down one and you give Minnesota a power play. And I didn't think that when I went back and looked at it, Michigan's power plays or penalty kills, they're only two, but neither one of them were great. They got a little bit lucky to escape, I think, because if you looked at the Corsi for two power plays, I believe Minnesota finished with somewhere around 16 attempts on net and 10 shots in only 4 power play minutes. Now, they didn't score, and Portillo made a number of saves, but this was not, like, the best two kills of the year for Michigan.
Yeah, they were just very slow getting out of the gate all the way around.
And I wrote down a note here, with 7:20 left in the first, shots were 13-3 Minnesota. And they did have the one power play, but they're also kind of getting caved in 5-on-5.
Yeah.
And that continues on as Portillo makes a save on a 3-on-2, and Chaz Lucius gets a pretty decent look as he splits two Michigan defensemen. Portillo makes a big save there, and it's like getting really kind of tight and tense. And then sort of the star power for Michigan as the first period comes to a close just takes it to a new level. And sort of I want to like highlight Edwards here because I've written about him a number of times almost every game for this half of the season, but he's really starting to come into his own. You've liked him all year. He makes a really nice play getting up the ice on transitioning from defense to offense, crosses the blue line, and has a really nice play where he hits a diagonal to Brisson on the back door, and Brisson has a wide open net, and it's 1-1 after Michigan has no chances. Minnesota has about 10, and Michigan makes their grade A chance count.
Yeah, I mean, that's the classic case of just a quality scoring chance being converted. Minnesota's defense in zone broke down a lot more often than it had the previous night in this game.
And it's nice to see you getting that contribution from Ethan Edwards, who had been making nice offensive plays but hadn't really gotten rewarded for it on the score sheet. And now, I mean, like, the way that he's progressing, you have a guy on every pairing for Michigan that can be sort of become that fourth player up in a rush from going from defense to offense.
Yeah, and he'll have a big role to play during the Olympics, too.
So. Correct. And it is of note that they did not dress Jack Summers, I believe, on Friday. They did on Saturday, but I don't remember seeing him a whole lot, if at all.
No, not that.
But he was dressed as an extra defenseman, maybe as like a threat to Truscott for like, hey, don't do that again,
yeah,
or else you're swapping with Jack over here. Yeah. And basically, while we're kind of taking these notes and getting everything organized after it's 1-1, Michigan gets their only odd man rush of the game on Saturday. It's a 4-on-2, and this is just classic Michigan with their stars of KJ getting in the zone, dish to power in the middle, and then he moves on to Beniers, and Close can't get across, and it's 2-1. And this is, again, you're just like, wow, you know, you play sort of a Minnesota period where they dominate the game, or the period, I should say, and then Michigan gets two chances, and they cash both of them. And it's 2-1. You're leaving the first period up 2-1 in a period where you're like, what just happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's a simple case of better in zone defense. And, you know, that second goal, I have to really see the replay. The angles that I have right now aren't great, but that one Close was able to get across decently in time and just wasn't able to make the stop.
So you think that might be an example of where, had that been LaFontaine, it might have been 1-1.
Could have. I mean, it wasn't really a one-timer when you watch the replay.
Yeah.
The pass comes across, and there's a bit of hesitation for a moment, and then Beniers shoots. And that allowed Close to get across and just didn't come up with it. So,
well, that will happen as you kind of drop down a tier in goaltending, I would say. So not a great period for Michigan, but a really good period for Michigan in other ways, as it's 2-1 going into the second. And then, you know, this is a note that we've kind of talked about at times throughout, but the first thing I have written down is KJ has a chance in the slot, or I should say in the house. He wasn't directly in the slot. And instead of throwing the puck on net, he does the typical fancy backhand to a trailer power who kind of blasts it into some people instead of just shooting. And, you know, this is going to happen again, but, you know, this is the thing about KJ at times that you just sort of would rather see him shoot the puck. You know, he has, what, 6 goals on the year, and not everything needs to be like a SportsCenter highlight. Like, in a game like this, just have a go, man.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some of the issues from the first period continued into the second. Michigan's defense got a little bit sloppy on giveaways and closing down. You had mentioned at the end of the first to me that sort of the gap control between the defense and the forwards was a little wider than you would like.
Well, forwards were able to walk in too close.
For Minnesota.
Yeah.
And then the defense was sitting a little bit deep, and then they had the momentum moving forward to taking shots. Thankfully, Portillo had one of his better games on the year. I think he ended up saving 39 of 40. And while he's had his issues with rebound control and a little bit of floppiness, he has a tendency, man, to just be able to use his size to make a lot of these saves. And he did a ton on Saturday. And Edwards had a play where he kind of got beat, and Portillo made a save. And then a bad... So then this is where – I think this is where the game really ended up changing. But, you know, the B&B line, Bortle and Brisson were paired with Pastrnak, which was different than Estapa the night before, which was interesting. But they have a really nice forecheck, and they force a couple defensive zone turnovers. The puck, I think, is – Lacombe is sort of under pressure, and he just loses it, goes off a skate right to Pasta, who shoots one, and it trickles through close. And this is kind of one of those situations where you're like, oh, it trickled through, like that's sort of on the goalie. But Pasta was also open from like 4 feet away. Like, I don't know. Do you put that on him at all? Because that's like,
yes,
that's a tough shot. That means
the shot was bad.
Okay. So the quality was not.
Like, yeah, I mean, there's a matter of it's what is the position of the guy and then what is the quality of the shot. And the shot was right into the body and he got most of it. And, you know, it trickles through. Like, don't love that.
So this is potentially 2 of these 3 goals that, if it was LaFontaine, maybe it's still 1-1?
Yeah, possibly.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's hard to sort of know those things, but I thought the more telling parts about Close was the way that he was sort of swimming in his crease a lot, and, I mean, there were times when he was getting over side to side and over-skating it. And leaving the backside open. And
he did. He leaked out to the side on a save where, in one of the games, I can't remember which one, where you would think he'd end up making the save in the crease, but ended up with the puck and was, like, outside the post.
Yeah.
And you're like, where are you going? Just floating over there. Minnesota has a chance to get right back in the game, though, after this, because it's 3-1. Michigan is changing the momentum, and Veneers checks a guy from behind. You know, he was kind of upset at this call, where he's kind of pointing, but, like, he did sort of, it wasn't a check. He kind of pushed the guy with, like, one hand, and he fell over, and it was, like, right on the edge of, is this going to be a major? Because the guy falls down, and his head doesn't quite hit the boards, but his shoulder does, and they made a big point on the broadcast of being, you know, the head has to hit the boards. That's what the major is. If you knock a guy down from back and his head hits the boards, that's 5 minutes. If it doesn't happen, it's probably not. And this was, I mean, you know, this is the PTSD that we all have of just like, well, it's close enough. This is going to be a major. Now they lose Beniers for the second half of this game.
I thought it was a good call to not make it.
Correct. I agree. It was more my emotions taking over that particular time. But so Minnesota gets a power play. Portillo makes a few saves. They kill it off, or so it appears, and Michigan has a bad change, and I believe it was Ben Myers that got in and behind the Michigan defense with a breakaway. Truscott is laid onto the ice, maybe because of that change, gets a little piece of him as he cuts across, and Portillo's able to get to the side, and Myers doesn't have a great angle, and there is a save. And that was a huge change in the game, a point in the game, too, because otherwise it's 3-2, and now we're back in the situation that you were on Friday. But you still hold that 3-1 lead. You're kind of getting outshot. At this point, it's about 29-12 in shots, which is like more than 2-1. Not great, but Portillo is just having a game.
Sometimes you need that from your goalie.
Yeah, and they did. And that basically continued on mostly through the second. They did get a couple of chances late, Michigan dead. Hughes with a really sweet stretch pass to Jimmy Lambert, who gets in, but the puck kind of hopped off his stick. Again, this was another KJ situation after that where he's just in the slot and just shoot the puck, man, you know? Especially when you're up 3-1, you don't need that. And the goalie has kind of not been perfect. I mean, if you get it on his frame, you might squeak one through, it's 4-1, and now the game's pretty much over. And then sort of like the, can you buy a goal? Samoskevich, right near the end of the period, has two shots from rather close range and somehow hits both posts. He takes one shot, hits a post, gets the rebound, hits the inside of the opposite post,
yep.
And neither puck goes in. And that's pretty much the end of the second period, and you're just like, What happens? Like, how are you supposed to, you know, maybe he was on the same line with Beecher and that's the problem. Maybe it's just the line.
Yeah, that
is there a cloud that
follows
people?
Eternally cursed.
It is snowing outside, right? So maybe that's what it was. So into the third, you feel better than certainly you did the previous day because you're up 3-1, but the gameplay isn't necessarily in your favor. But I thought this was Michigan's best period of the day. They pretty much held serve on shots. They did have some scoring chances, but didn't get overrun. Portillo made a number of saves. I thought Minnesota missed a few chances. Sorensen had a good chance and shot it wide, and I was, you know, that was a really good chance for the Gophers. KJ walked in the slot, and hey, guess what? He shot it. It went high and wide, but at least he took a rip on net. Beecher had a really good chance firing down the wing, created a rebound, they couldn't get net. So at this point, you're like, okay, this is actually some good offense. That they're creating. Portillo's making saves throughout this period, keeping Michigan at that two-goal lead. And then Minnesota does get one back temporarily on a hand punch. And do hand punch goals count, Alex?
No.
So you can't punt it into the net, and you can't punch it into the net? Is that what we learned this weekend?
Yes.
Okay. And then you see vintage Owen Power, or what you want to see in Owen Power. He gets the puck out of his own zone, skates through the neutral zone, enters, doesn't see anything, kind of does a curly Q, coming back around, keeps his head up, sees his partner on the opposite side, Nick Blankenberg, has a really nice pass to get it to the open space. Nick Blankenberg walks in, doesn't panic and shoot, but walks and takes his space well and shoots and beats close. And it's 4-1, and at that point, that's pretty much game.
Yeah, that's one where Michigan has been aiming high all weekend, and they finally get one over the shoulder where they've got close down in the butterfly, and he's just not tall enough with his shoulder. At first, it looked like he was still somehow beaten short side, but I think it was more just one over the shoulder, and it was a height thing, having watched it on replay a number of times.
Man has given up a couple of those in his day. Yeah, I mean, we remember him getting beaten like that. That'll happen just when you're that size. Which is probably what NHL GMs are like, unless you're 6'4", you can't be a goalie now. So that doesn't happen, more or less. I mean, now, because when Portillo does that, you pretty much have to hit, like, the head of a pin.
Hey, I mean, like, maybe the second best goalie in the league right now in the NHL is 5'11", so still some hope. Just, you have to be outrageously athletic, like Saros is, so.
Yes. Well, I mean, and Hasek wasn't huge either, right? He just had a slinky for a spine, as the MasterCard commercial said.
Basically.
Yeah. And so then one last talking point. This sort of happened at the end or on Friday. It definitely happened on Saturday, where there was a scramble in front and it looked like Portillo's trying to flop on it. But on replay, it's pretty obvious that Edwards covered the puck and was in the crease. And I mean, that's a penalty shot, right?
It should be, yeah.
But it wasn't called because college reffing? Because
got off the hook,
reffing?
Basically. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a good luck play more.
I mean, it just seemed pretty obvious as you see the replay from over top that there's no way, unless Portillo changes bodies with Edwards. And then two power plays, like we mentioned, for Minnesota throughout this game. No power plays for Michigan because Minnesota did not commit a penalty for the first 59 plus minutes of this game. And then with 42 seconds left, I'm trying to remember if it was maybe Brodzinski or McLaughlin. I can't remember who it was. Hit a Michigan player in the back and could have been a major. It wasn't because, sure. And then Michigan gets their power play for 2 minutes with like 42 seconds left. And you're just like, all right, thanks.
Few better times to take a penalty than in the last 50 seconds of a game you're going to lose.
Chance to get your shot in. So Michigan doesn't even try. They skate the game out. They walk away with a 4-1 win in a game that they took their and finished their chance as well. Didn't maybe create the most they have all year, but Portillo had as good a game as he's had. I mean, he's played well in a number of games. That second Western game comes to mind. But this was a game that they really wanted. I won't say they needed, but really wanted. Got it, thanks to the big sweep. So, four-point weekend. I mean, that's would you, you've taken that, right, going in?
Yeah. I mean, you made it so now that Minnesota is six back, obviously the two in hand, so basically if they win both of those in regulation, then you're even. And overall, I think that puts you in a spot where you don't feel super worried about Minnesota at the moment.
Yeah, this is a good transition.
For me, having watched Minnesota this weekend, seeing their goaltending situation, knowing they will be as shorthanded as Michigan will through February, I'm not super worried now about that.
So Michigan, like you said,
if you'd won both in regulation, you'd have buried them completely. But now you're just in a comfortable spot with regards to the Gophers.
So Minnesota is 6 points behind, but they have two games in hand. But let's go through their schedule. At Notre Dame, that's tough, right? I mean, to get six there is
that's this coming weekend.
That's this week. So
they'll cheer for a split.
Yes. Then they host Michigan State on Michigan's bye week, which is the first Olympic week.
So they lose. So they have the Olympics gone for three weekends.
Right, and they play all week, all three.
Yes, MSU, OSU, and Penn State.
Right. So the Michigan State, you can theoretically beat them twice, but they can also goal you, especially if you give up a goal and you know close in a couple of the games. You know the Alaska game, he had 12 saves on 15 shots. So it's not a guarantee. You still probably would. I'm not shocked if Minnesota gets all six there, but then they go to Ohio State, and they have to play in...
Cheer for a split.
A slop fest. Maybe even more for Minnesota, depending on how everything else goes. And then they go to Penn State, and that's not an easy place to play either. Michigan did get a sweep there, but Penn State, when they played Michigan at Yost, was a lot better and tougher than I thought.
Penn State's not a terrible team.
No.
I mean, they're not good, but, you know, a thing that's coloring the picture of the Big Ten right now is the fact that the Big Ten is a good conference this year. There have been years since its existence that it has been a bad conference, but the center of power in college hockey has really shifted this season towards the Western conferences.
Yes.
Our old friend Nate Wells has been covering that decently. Let me pull up the most recent statistics about the ECAC and the Hockey East versus WCHA, NCHC, and Big Ten, but it's pretty one way.
It was like 5-12 and some ties or something like that, 5-14. I mean, it was not particularly close from what I remember. Yeah, because I remember this was, I think you probably even referenced this or retweeted it or commented on it, something like that. But yeah, I mean, the Big Ten has four really good teams, and Penn State, like you said, is not a bad team.
So against the three Western, this was during the week.
Okay.
I don't think there were any rule non-conference games to have changed this, though.
There was on Wednesday.
Yeah, this was after that.
Okay.
The Hockey East is 5-14-2 against the three Western conferences, and the ECAC is 8-15-4 against the three Western conferences.
Yeah, that's what, maybe 33%?
Yeah, not good.
25%, yeah.
And so what that has done is when you look at the pairwise numbers, not great for those Eastern conferences. You look at the top 4, all of which are Western teams. Then you have UMass at 5. You have
UMass is number 5 in pairwise?
Yes, they are.
Wow.
QPAC's now at 7.
And they were 1. They must have lost on Saturday.
And then the next 8 through 13, all Western teams.
Yeah.
Duluth, Tech, OSU, Minnesota, ND, and then Merrimack slots in at 14. Lowell is at 15, Providence at 16, Northeastern at 17. So right now, you basically have the Hockey East champion, the ECAC champion, your projected champions,
sure,
at 5 and 7,
yeah,
and nobody else outside the bubble from those two conferences.
That's kind of crazy. I mean, it's not a shock in some senses because NCHC has been good for a while.
But the Hockey East is normally a 4-bid league.
Right. But with the addition of the Big Ten looking like they have a shot to get 4 teams, I don't know if all 4 of them will make it because you basically have 3 in the bottom 5 or 6. So you're going to have, you know, one of those teams is probably going to lose because they're going to play each other and all of that. But I think that's been the biggest jump is you have 4 potential tournament-worthy teams in the Big Ten.
Well, the reason I brought the segue we got here on is the fact that Penn State has a bad conference record. But the reason I say they're not a bad team is they are 14-12 overall, plus 12 goal differential overall. And because the way we know that the Big Ten is good this year, you know, they're better than teams in other conferences. That's why they have a good non-con record. And why they're 22 in pairwise. They got really hot in February, and I mean, it sucks for them that they can't beat Michigan anymore, but they can, let me see, what's their schedule? They play Minnesota, they play Notre Dame, and they play Ohio State. I mean, if they went 3-3 over that stretch or 4-2 over that stretch, you could see them get into the picture.
So
it'd be surprising, but it could happen because the Big Ten is just better than those other conferences right now.
So we're rooting for Jess Pegula and her Lions?
Yeah.
I mean, because all it's going to do is help Michigan, right?
Yeah.
The better that they get, Michigan's beaten 4 times.
Yes.
So, and they knock down everybody else. I mean, that gives Michigan a potential bye week, which would be nice.
Yeah.
And a banner. So... Minnesota is they're pretty much going to have to, I'm not going to say win out, but they're going to have to win most, if not all, their games to really have a chance to get the 1 seed in the Big Ten. Yeah?
Probably.
Notre Dame is 9 points behind Michigan, but they have 2 games in hand. And they host Minnesota this weekend. That's a tough series because Minnesota's still going to have all their players. They go to...
I think that your hope is that those two teams split and you sweep Wisconsin and you've got a stranglehold over them.
Yeah.
Entering February.
Yep. So they host Minnesota, they host Penn State, which as we just said is not a layup. I mean, you would probably think Notre Dame gets more points than Penn State, but that's not as easy. They go to Wisconsin, which, I mean, we'll talk about Wisconsin in a minute. They're not great. And then they go to Michigan State, which kind of the same thing, except you have the goalie factor there. And then they host Michigan in a series that will probably decide who's going to win the Big Ten. Maybe not Notre Dame, but Michigan is probably going to be one of the 2 to 3 teams in it then.
Yeah, I mean, as long as Michigan... If you told me right now that Michigan will have their players against Notre Dame in the last week of the season...
You feel pretty good.
I feel okay about finishing ahead of Notre Dame.
So then we get down to the one team that probably is the biggest threat to Michigan right now for several reasons. One, they're tied with Michigan on games and points.
Mostly the Olympics, though.
And then they don't lose any players to the Olympics, and that's the Ohio State Buckeyes. But their schedule is no layup either. They have to go to Penn State this weekend. Again, not always the easiest place to get points. Penn State is playing better than they have been, as we discussed. They go to Madison. Okay, well, Ohio State's probably going to get the majority of the points, if not all of them, in that weekend. Then they host... Oh, no, they don't go to Madison. I'm sorry. That's in Columbus. And then they host Minnesota, but not full-strength Minnesota. It's still hard for me to see Minnesota dropping all 6, just because at some point they do have all their players. And then Ohio State comes to Yost for their last series. It will not be Michigan's. They will have the last week at Notre Dame, but that's going to be when Ohio State comes to Yost in a few weeks. It's going to be their last chance to secure Big Ten points.
You're really cheering for Penn State this weekend against Ohio State.
As we do in most sports. So there's not a whole lot to take from the Big Ten games this weekend because basically Penn State lit up Wisconsin. I think the thing of note there is we'll go through the Wisconsin's preview statistics in a second, but they lit them up 4-1 and 7-2. The two things I took out of that were Mo was chased in both games. He gave up 3 goals and 29 shots and 5 goals and 36 shots. Corsi was even-ish in shots in the first game. In the second game, Penn State had a better Corsi of 93-47, which is kind of insane. Wisconsin does not seem to do a whole lot. They score 3 goals against that Penn State defense. You have to like Michigan's chances coming up this weekend, especially with all their players. The other thing is Ohio State beat Michigan State 4-1 and 3-2. You were mentioning how Michigan State potentially played their best game of the season, out shooting and Corsiing Ohio State 73-50, but Dobish kind of stole the game, at least the second one.
I mean, that's what I was told. I did not watch that game, but that's what people who do were saying.
But Ohio State did what they have to do in taking points off of a weaker opponent and not falling behind Michigan. In fact, gaining because Michigan dropped some points in Minneapolis. And the last game was Notre Dame played BC, not a Big Ten game, but I watched that game because I have a good friend who's a Notre Dame fan, and we watched it together, and Notre Dame hung 8 on the Eagles, and that was a bit of a surprise.
Obviously, I mean, it's just sort of like a wow, Boston College is bad this year, and they're really bad right now. They've lost, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 straight games, only one of which not in overtime. So
the other thing, though, is that this is not the Notre Dame team that only scores 2 goals a game either. I mean, they did score 8 in this game, and if you scroll through their scores, they've scored 5, I think, once against Michigan, and
yeah,
they will put up some goals. So it is not the Jeff Jackson, I'm going to beat you 3-2 and 3-1. This is a team that, if you give them chances, will score goals.
Yeah.
All right. Last thing we'll touch on is sort of Minnesota, which we already kind of did, but 38th in pairwise, not great. 32nd.
I think you meant Wisconsin.
Did I say Minnesota?
Yeah.
Hey, you know, Northern Big Ten teams are not the same. So, yes, I meant Wisconsin. 38th in pairwise, 32nd in Corsi, which is very Wisconsin-y for the players that they seem to have. 17% on the power play is not great. 71% penalty kill. This is where Michigan could win this game because their power play has still been pretty good. Obviously, we know about the players that they have. That's going to be a decided advantage, I think, to Michigan. Michigan's penalty kill has been solid, as we noted earlier. They have 10 drafted skaters, which is more than I would have anticipated, but only one in the first 3 rounds.
Yeah, they have some guys. I mean, the big story with Wisconsin is a simple number, 6.2. That's their team shooting percentage. Worst in college hockey. Number 58 out of 50.
6.2?
Yeah. So that, I mean, they're scoring barely 2 goals per game because they cannot shoot at all. And there's no doubt some degree of randomness there and reversion you'd expect to see over time.
So Michigan handled them pretty well in the first game at Yost, and the second game was the turnover meltdown game. Was that right? That was the Bordalo, what are you doing
yes.
game, and among other things. And that's how they got their goals. They have 0 guys scoring over 0.75 points per game. I don't think in any preview I've made since I've been looking at this for multiple years, I've ever written down that a team has 0 guys with those. I think their leading goal scorer has 7, and that's only one person. And then it's
and that's a defenseman, by the way.
Right. And their goalie numbers are also not great. I only took Mo because he has more games.
But Cameron Rose played 10 games.
And his numbers are even worse. And Mo is at 2.75.
Oh, and Mo has got a 920 save percentage, so he's been pretty good this year.
That's all right, yeah. But his goals against is 2.75, which is high-ish.
Yeah, which that's more indictment of the defense, probably.
Probably.
You've got a 920, but you're at 2.75.
And Rowe is, I think, over 3 GAA, and his save percentage is poor.
I mean, the fact is about Wisconsin that You know, I don't think anyone has ever studied the rules of PDO when it comes to college hockey, but at least in the NHL, the old heuristic about which teams are overperforming, underperforming is whether your PDO, which is just your team save percentage plus your team shooting percentage, which over an 82-game NHL season should always come about to 100%.
Sort of like the power play penalty kill thing?
Yeah, but that's more just like what is good, whereas in just the law of averages, everyone should average out to about 100%, right?
Okay.
Just logically, shooting percentage plus save percentage, if you took all 30, 32 teams, then...
Sure.
So any team with above 100% is often, if they're at like 103, you look at that as like, oh, that's a team that's going to call them back to earth. Now, college hockey is different. It's not one league, that sort of thing. But Wisconsin's at 96.
That's
not good. I mean, that's that's below what you would think is like a more reasonable thing.
Is it bad or is it just not good?
Well, in the NHL, it's more like that's when you see 96, that means more random than anything else that you're getting bad luck. But in college hockey, you have a lot less parity. So probably a sign of bad, but also... It's really hard for a team with this talent to shoot 6%. I think that is probably some degree of just bad luck.
So could that revert to the mean against Michigan?
Possibly.
Well, both games are, I guess, viewable in one way or another. The Friday game is at 7 p.m. Eastern time on our old friend BTN-. So far, hopefully it gets picked up maybe by FS or Bally
Channel.
Sports,
yeah,
D
Bally
or
Sports,
someone,
yeah.
But as of right now, it's going to be on the pay-per-view station. And then the Saturday night game is at 9 p.m. My goodness, I don't want to stay up that late. But
hey, it's good news. It is after hockey night in Canada. The early game should be getting done. So,
but it's also on BTN, so that one will be a little bit clearer of a viewing. So I think I would accept 5 points in this series, but I think Michigan needs to get six. I mean, they're clearly better. You might have that reversion to the mean thing we just talked about, but anything less than five is going to be frustrating, I would say, for Michigan this weekend.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, you need to hammer Wisconsin, and you need to get revenge for what happened previously.
At Yost.
Yes, and then go from there.
And while you still have your guys, make them count.
Yeah. Michigan Hockey Cast 4.14 for Alex Tran, David Masternak. Come back next week where we will be discussing the USMTDP.